Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The day after the sixth anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, we hear from a senior police intelligence analyst who believes the four alleged bombers didn't do it. And he was promptly sacked. Why does he think that, and who did it, and how's his claim for unfair dismissal going? We're asking too, was 7/7 a false flag attack, a big lie to make the terror threat real? We look into NATO's history of false flags, the murkiest chapter in NATO's past, secret terror squads murdering European civilians and blaming it on their enemies to bounce the press, politicians and people into war. The notorious Operation Gladio. Not conspiracy theory, as some would try to lull you into believing, but conspiracy fact, backed up by parliamentary inquiries in Italy, Belgium and Switzerland. And the murderous planners behind it all managed to keep their jobs at NATO headquarters in Brussels. And the strange death 2 weeks ago of the Prime Minister's Witney Constituency Party chair, Christopher Shale, at Glastonbury, in a toilet, after he said that the Tory party was voracious, crass and always on the take. I speak to a barrister who believes he was assassinated and also believes he knows who did it. And Gloucestershire's annual extravaganza of military air power, the Fairford Air Tattoos, coming up next weekend. But not everyone's happy with the role of the RAF in 2011, so peace activists are preparing an invasion of USAF Fairford. But first, as the banking crisis bites, you could become a squatter in your own home. If the banks try and repossess it, that is. What do Bristol squatters think of the Conservative plans to criminalise squatting? Well, I'm joined now by two squatters, or at least involved with squatting in Bristol. That's Kitty O'Donoghue and Ben Ritchie. Hi, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, first of all, Kitty, you first. What's your connection with squatting?
Well, I used to be a squatter, and I squatted for about 10 years of my adult life, eventually getting into social housing as my son got older. And I went to college and have been qualifying myself to work ever since, basically. So it was a leg up for me. The reason why I came to Bristol was to be with members of my community who could support me as a single parent, and squatting was our way of life at that point. It was the cheapest way to live, but it was also a social way of living, a way of working together to create better futures for ourselves and our children.
How do you actually find yourself homeless in the first place?
I was living on the road before I had my son, basically. I was involved in the road protests of Newbury, and so I was by nature a homeless person. I was a transient. I'm by nature a transient, and that's where I came from.
Do you think part of the problem here is that for many people who you've been used to travelling in years gone by, and if you go right back to the gypsies and people like that, that there's now a great deal of pressure on people to actually move into a house and stay in a house? What kind of pressure is there?
It's a huge amount of pressure. I mean, the travelling community in Britain is being targeted massively. There's a huge eviction just about to be made in Basildon of people who were forced to buy their own land. There are Irish travellers in a place called Dale Farm who were forced to buy their own land after the Criminal Justice Bill came through in the 1990s, and it's now been made illegal for them to live on their own land in the way that they choose to. So that's just one extreme example, but planning laws and other laws are making it more and more difficult for people to travel and to be able to move around the country.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned Dale Farm in Essex, because it looks to be one of the biggest evictions ever to be seen in Britain. With special money from central government, the local authority down there planned to evict an entire gypsy site where hundreds of people have been encouraged to settle. This week, the mostly Irish travellers were served with eviction papers.
We are willing to die if that's what it's going to take.
We're using gas cylinders. We will turn the gas on and set them on fire. We're using tyres, petrol bombs, generators. Whatever it takes to try and defend our homes, we are going to do.
We're going to have some caravans along here that we're going to set alight. And all the while this is going on, you can see the dogs, children, everyone is going to be standing around it.
And we're not going peacefully. If they want us out of it, they'll bring us out in body bags. Because we are going to die at the side of the road, so we as well have to die here.
Hey-ho, we won't go!
Come on, Bailiffs!
Prams were wheeled up to the barricades to show, said the travellers, the danger children would face if any eviction goes ahead.
We're willing for our babies and ourselves to die fighting for this land, because otherwise if we leave, we have no future, we have nowhere to go. Half us cannot leave with babies and infants. We've nowhere to go.
That was from a BBC report earlier this week on the serving of eviction papers onto the Dale Farm Travellers site in Essex. And back to you, Kitty. Is that a sort of sentiment that you're familiar with? I mean, the people there are almost at the point of despair because they actually have nowhere at all to go. The place where they've bought some land, they're now being evicted from.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people that I know who travel are of a different style of travelling, which are new travellers, and they're very much underrepresented as a group, and are beginning to group together now because the laws are changing so rapidly and making their lifestyles very difficult. A lot of these people travel for a living, basically. They travel seasonally, they get seasonal work, especially at festivals and entertainment for a huge amount of other people who are settled, but they go to the festivals and in Bristol alone, just as an example, we have the Invisible Circus, which I heard being talked about yesterday on one of the shows on BCFM, who have just had a massive impact, cultural impact on Bristol City. And those people started as squatters and travellers. A lot of them remain travellers. And the way that they were able to qualify themselves as circus artists and artists generally was by having low income, low status in terms of housing, so that they could get on with learning their skills. And then they went on to create amazing spaces in empty buildings. Firstly, the first building that they took was on the end of Cheltenham Road. It was the old Audi garage. And it's not just a matter of moving into a building like that. You have to move into a building and then you have to do a good few weeks, if not months, graft to make it livable in, to make it possible for people to come in and enjoy the artistic entertainment that they've produced. And they've gone on to make responsible use of buildings in a couple of different places in the city, and have actually forced the hand of developers to use those buildings responsibly since then as well. But as I say, those people were both squatters and travellers first and foremost.
Now, Ben Ritchie, you're from Bristol Housing Action here too. Why should I pay rent while squatters just don't have to? They're freeloaders, aren't they?
Many people squat for a number of reasons. You've got to understand that rents are extremely high historically. People simply can't afford them. The government hasn't built any council housing for a very long time. Council rents are being forced up to private values, and people just are finding that with bills rising, rents rising, they simply can't make ends meet. There are other people who can't cope with the whole complicated business of paying bills, council tax and rents, and they just find it too difficult, and often find themselves for that reason just out on the street. So you've got to understand that people who squat have a technical reason for squatting. They simply cannot either afford the rent or simply can't cope. So to say that people who are renting should look down or ask for those who are squatting to be evicted is to ignore what society is doing to the homeless.
Now, what's going on at the free shop at the bottom of Stokes Croft? Because one minute they're in and one minute they're evicted and then they're in again, you know, so it seems that there's this popping in and out. Can you just tell us what's going on with the free shop? This is a two buildings, one of which is a collectively run art gallery, and the other one is a basically like a charity shop where people come and give stuff, and it's actually you don't have to pay for it.
Well, it seems first that a group of people up to a dozen people have now got back in. The building has been care of the Orbis Sitex company, and the bailiffs turned into a miniature fortress with steel cladding on all windows and doors of the entire building.
But that was meant to keep people out, but now it's almost like keeping the bailiffs out, and the people have got back in.
Sitex is for site protection against thieves. It doesn't work against people who have nowhere else to go, and therefore it can be turned against itself.
So what are people's rights as a squatter? What are your rights if you go and squat a building?
You have the right to not be evicted with violence, and normally to go through the normal court proceedings which owners can take in courts.
What about gas, electricity, water? Do squatters pay those bills?
Now, this is up to them. We advise people to make the correct choice. The minimum we advise people to do is to make readings of all services they are using, so that they can, if they stay long enough, make sure they pay their bills.
Okay, and how can people find out more about squatting in Bristol? What's the contact points for Bristol Housing Action?
Well, there are a number of contact points. Quite obviously, if you simply go now to the steel clad Free Shop and Emporium Art Gallery, you've got a ready made place to go and voice your issues. There is the telephone number we work on, which is a continual 24-hour, 7-day-a-week advice line. There's housingaction@yahoo.co.uk. There's a box number. So we have a wide number of ways of people getting in, and surprisingly, a lot of people come in by word of mouth because they've heard that they can get somewhere to live off the pavement that night.
And the website is squatbristol.org. UK. Finally then, both of you, maybe you first, Kitty, what are your thoughts about the government's plans to criminalise squatting?
Well, I really can't understand why they're doing it. I mean, I've looked at some statistics. There's 652,000 empty homes in England. That's not buildings, but homes in England. In Bristol City alone, there's roughly 7,000, and in the southwest, 70,000 empty homes. There's been a quote in the last week that 40,000 families will be made homeless because of welfare reforms in the next few months. And the Citizens Advice Bureau last year saw a 14% rise in housing problems over 3 months, basically. So this is a crisis beyond imagining. We're going to come up to another hard winter very soon, and they're talking about criminalising a basic right which has been there for hundreds of years in this country since law began. It has been legal to find yourself shelter in any situation.
Well, it's also there in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, isn't it? What are your thoughts, Ben, about how this is going to affect, if this does go through and squatting is criminalised? Because, I mean, you can see what's going on here is we're in a financial crisis. There's more and more and more properties actually becoming empty. So there's the potential for a real boom in squatting.
Well, we've expected this from the Conservatives, that they will just become nasty, screw down people. But the problem is, of course, it won't do anything very useful. People can't go away. They can't leave Earth. They can gather on the pavements. But it's just insanity, really. And I think what people have got to realise is that if you're going to have an economic crisis, as you point out, then there's got to be a practical way to resolve the situation. Legislation simply can't do it. What will happen, I think, is what happened with the legislation against drugs. The problem becomes much, much worse, and it actually spirals out of control completely. If that's what they want, that's what's going to happen.
Well, that's Kitty O'Donoghue and Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Thank you both very much for joining us. And I'll leave you with a report by Dispatches earlier this week called The Landlords from Hell. And here is John Snow.
Tonight, Dispatches uncovers the rogue landlords breaking the law and getting away with it. This is how one of them deals with his tenants. This slum landlord owns hundreds of properties and even claims charitable status for his business. But he doesn't sound so charitable when it comes to rent.
That's the idiot who said he weren't going to pay us. He came back and found his and someone else living in it. It's as simple as that.
Our undercover reporter infiltrates this property empire, and we reveal the scams they pull, targeting the most vulnerable and ruining people's lives. and I confront the landlord from hell living in luxury whilst his tenants suffer.
I'm John Snow from Channel 4 Dispatches. We've been investigating Meridian Investments and we've got some questions we'd like to ask you. Before I became a journalist, I ran a day centre for homeless and badly housed young people in central London. I saw the appalling conditions in which they lived. I tried to intervene in the racketeering and exploitation that they suffered. Since then, both Labour and Conservative governments have passed laws supposedly to protect people in the private rented sector. 40 years on, I could never have dreamt that that racketeering, that exploitation, would be back. But it is.
The private rental market has taken off. A chronic shortage of social housing, an influx of immigrants, and large numbers of people priced out of the housing market have led to a 40% rise in the number of households over the past 5 years. Now there are 3.4 million households in the private rented sector. The new slum landlords are not hard to find.
That was John Snow earlier this week on Dispatches, Landlords from Hell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, Gloucestershire's annual extravaganza of military air power, the Fairford Air Tattoo, is coming up next weekend. But RAF objectives have done an about turn since World War II's Spitfire and the Lancaster. Even though they'll be there mingling with the modern jets, many see this as pure propaganda. Far from defending freedom, the latest Libya-bound jets have killed and seriously injured, at the latest count, about 2,000 civilians since the campaign to protect civilians began. So peace activists are preparing to cycle to Fairford. I'm joined by Kevin Lister, who's organising next weekend's bike ride. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hey, Tony. How are you?
Fine. Now, what is the point? What's the point of cycling over there?
There's a number of really important points on this. There's the whole issue on climate change, firstly. And that was the first thing that really got us fired and angry on this one. This single event negates virtually everybody's efforts on climate change and virtually the whole of Gloucestershire. You know, we're bringing B-52 bombers over for a weekend's fun and games, and yet at the same time everyone else is being told to walk and cycle and eat vegetarian and so forth. So it negates and makes a mockery of the whole climate change thrust that the government is pushing forward. Now, again, what you were saying before, that you know, this is a great big propaganda extravaganza. It is an point of absolute arrogance that they are bringing the American A-10 ground attack plane over, and for people who do not know, the A-10 ground attack plane specializes in firing depleted uranium. So we now have not just thousands, but tens, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of people standing to die through depleted uranium.
But depleted uranium is one of the most sort of high-tech modern weapons, isn't it? I mean, they need that stuff, surely.
It is. You are absolutely right. Depleted uranium gives the forces an unequivocal advantage in battle, and it's that unequivocal advantage in battle that makes it so much easier for countries to declare war. If we did not have depleted uranium, would the Americans been so keen to declare that second war on Iraq?
Well, I'm not sure, but aren't you spoiling a nice day out for the kids? I mean, well, not all the kids. Usually the girls aren't so interested. It's mostly the boys, isn't it?
Well, I don't believe that we are spoiling it. This is not a game anymore. These are serious, serious tools of destruction, and we should not be, as a democratic and responsible society, we should not be trying to indoctrinate our young people into the killing machine.
So anyway, what's your group, your organisation? Are you just an ordinary cycling campaign? You don't sound like you are.
It's a hodgepodge of various groups. It's typical of the environment movement. We're non-hierarchical. There's various groups and organisations that are getting involved. Plain Stupid, Biofuel Watch, Child Victims of War. And this is an event that really impinges on everything that is wrong in our society.
If anyone's out there, a keen cyclist, they've got the bicycle at the ready, it's all oiled up, how can they get in touch with you and come along on your cycle ride?
Yeah, they can email me. My email address is kevin.lister@btopenworld.com.
Only email? Have you got a phone number or a website?
Yeah, my phone number is 07768991063, and my blog is called Kev's Climate Column. So if you Google Kev's Climate Column, you'll get all the details there. Kevin, and we'll be delighted to have as many people as possible,
including police infiltrators, perhaps.
Including police infiltrators. In fact, we've had in this particular event, we've had extremely good cooperation from the police. I mean, at the moment, we've had other bad experiences with the police leading up to the Fairford 82 last year, but you know the police have been very, very cooperative, so you know fair praise to them. What we're also asking the police to do as well is to investigate the A10 pilots for breaches of the Geneva Convention.
Now, because the stuff they're firing is actually radioactive, isn't it? And it can poison generations and generations infinitely into the future of people living in the countries where it's fired.
It is a horrific ecological disaster. In Fallujah, about 25% of all babies die within weeks of birth. Around about 15 to 17% of all babies are born with horrific deformities. There's been a step change increase across Iraq in cancers, in particular in young children.
So you're actually going to be cycling into the Fairford Air Base? Because it's a very, very long perimeter. It's miles and miles right round. I mean, surely that's a possibility. In fact, we had Lindis Percy on the show here last week from the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases, saying she just basically just hopped over the fence and sat under a B-52 for several hours with no one noticing.
We're not intending to get into the base. I think during the Air 2 that would not be possible.
But you could actually have your bicycles with people on top of each other, maybe, and the person on the top goes over the fence.
Well, that's always a possibility. I would not like to give too much away on air. But basically what we want to do is have a critical mass of cyclists riding to the air show. What we'll be looking at doing is setting up stalls and stands to look at climate change, depleted uranium, social justice, climate justice at the gates of the Air 2, so we can inform and debate with the enthusiasts of this kind of industry on a one-to-one basis as they go in.
And so if there are any police infiltrators listening, whereabouts should they go to join the bike ride from, or what time and place?
Well, police infiltrators can give me a call on the mobile number I gave before. I'll give it again. It's 07768 991063.
And how far is it from here to Fairford?
Well, from Bristol to Fairford, it's about 50 miles. I cycled down here the other day. It took me 2.5 hours, but I was cycling as fast as I could.
Oh, I hate to think of it. I think if Martin and I were on our bicycles, you'd be way ahead of us, so we'd probably be about an hour behind you.
Yeah, but you can get the train to Kemble, and again, if you phone me in advance, then we can arrange for you to be picked up. We can also organise bike hire for you as well.
Thank you very much for that. That sounds fascinating. It'd be nice to hear how you get on as well.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, a false flag terror attack is when the group, country or political faction blamed for a bomb or other outrage are actually the enemy of the people who actually carried it out. It's rather like the grisly phenomenon of self-harming. The aim is simple: to make an aggressor look like a victim and the victim look like the aggressor. One telltale sign of this is when there's a very quick revelation as to who's behind an attack, like on 9/11 and 7/7, when Bush and Blair respectively announced on the day of the attacks that Islamic factions were likely to be behind it. But NATO has a disturbing track record of this kind of cowardly attack. It's called Operation Gladio, and it was supposed to be the most secret operation NATO ever carried out. But some of those tasked to carry out these attacks were so disgusted with what they'd been ordered to do that they blew the whistle. Swiss historian Daniel Ganser and I spoke to him recently about the topic of his book, because he's done thorough research on the subject, starting in London. His book is called NATO's Secret Armies.
Historian researching international politics and economic affairs of the last 60 years. I teach at Basel University in Switzerland, and my book, NATO's Secret Armies, Operation Gladio and Terrorism in Western Europe, deals with secret warfare in Western Europe during the Cold War. In Italy, the secret army was named Gladio, so many people know of the whole story. With that keyword Gladio, because if you type in Gladio on the internet, that's really the keyword that brings you to these secret armies. And it was the name of the Stay Behind army of NATO in Italy, and it was discovered in 1990, so that's already 20 years ago. A Stay Behind army is a secret network of soldiers who waits until an invasion has actually happened and until a country is occupied. So it stays behind enemy lines and has arms caches across the country and then fights the occupying powers. So it's sort of special forces who operate behind enemy lines. The important thing to understand is that the secret armies had two purposes. First, they were to be ready in case of a Soviet invasion. I mean, if you think back the Cold War, we always had this fear in Western Europe that the Soviet Union would invade and occupy Western Europe. So British and American soldiers and generals planned for that event and therefore set up secret armies. But they were not only fearing a Soviet invasion, they were also fearing communist parties who were active in democracies of Western Europe quite in peacetime, you know. And so some of the terrorist attacks that were carried out in Italy seemed to be linked to right-wing terrorists who carried out these attacks with support of the secret armies and then blamed them on the Italian communists and the socialists just to discredit the left. I mean, that is called false flag terrorism, and it works.
Why should you really fear a communist party if that communist party, as in Italy, for example, is democratically elected and that's what the people want?
Because the communist party in Italy, you know, they were very strong in parliament. They had some 30% of the vote. At some point, you know, if you're strong in the legislative branch, you want to have minister positions. So you want maybe to have the interior minister or you want to have the defense minister. An Italian defense minister from a communist party would have been a total nightmare for NATO, because within NATO they were circulating all NATO secrets, and they thought that the Italian communists would hand over these NATO secrets directly to Moscow. So this idea that the Italian population votes for somebody whom NATO doesn't want was really the problem during the Cold War. We didn't have full sovereignty. We had democracies, but the democracy was limited. You see that in the case of Aldo Moro, who was assassinated when he wanted to bring the Italian communists into the government. I mean, he was a high-ranking politician, but he was assassinated.
There were terrorist attacks in the 1980s, particularly in Italy. Can you give us an example of a couple of those which initially people thought were sponsored by the Soviet Union but actually turned out to be run by NATO?
The most famous attack is the one of 1972, which was carried out in Peteano. It was just a small attack with like two or five people who were lured to a car, and the car then exploded. There was a few policemen who were lured to the place by an anonymous phone call. This attack was first blamed on the Red Brigade. So there was an anonymous phone call and who said this attack had been carried out by the Red Brigades. And then everybody thought, okay, it was the left. And then 10 years later, an Italian judge, Felice Casson, investigated the attack again and found out that it had been a right-wing terrorist, Vincenzo Vinciguerra. So there we have the exact names. And the man, Vinciguerra, then confessed that he carried out the attack. And he said, yeah, but we were protected by NATO. They had a secret network. And everybody was saying, yeah, the man is just lying. You know, he's going to be crazy. But 10 years later, Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti had to confirm that indeed there was a secret army named Gladio within the Italian military secret services. And then NATO had to take a stand. NATO first said, we don't want to comment. And then on the next day, they said, yes, there exists something like that, but we can't talk about it because it's a military secrecy. And still today, NATO does not want to talk about Gladio. I mean, most people know that NATO is involved in the war against Libya, but they have no clue about secret operations of NATO during the Cold War.
So what about this operation, Gladio, or Gladio, as he calls it? What is the extent of it, I asked him? And how on earth to penetrate the secrecy of NATO to actually find out who's organising this?
We know now that we had secret armies in Germany, in Belgium, in Italy, in Greece, in Turkey, in France, in Portugal, in Spain, in Norway, in Denmark. In all countries of Western Europe, we had these secret armies. That is a confirmed fact. The second thing which is confirmed is that these secret armies were linked to NATO and MI6, the British Secret Service, and CIA, the American Secret Service, and that they were trained by special forces, the SIS and the special forces of the US, the Green Berets. That is what we know, but we also know that in these countries we had terrorist attacks, but now to link the terrorist attacks in each country to the secret soldiers is very complicated, because we don't have written documentation from NATO which says, for instance, in Belgium we had a series of terrorist attacks, and we can prove we had terrorist attacks, but we don't know what the secret soldiers were linked. In fact, the Belgian Senate tried to investigate the links between the secret army, which existed in Belgium, that is confirmed, and the series of terrorist attacks which are called the Brabant massacres, which took place in the 1980s. And in Germany we had another terrorist attack in Munich in 1980, which was also supposedly linked to the secret network. But there again, you know, people died who wanted to make a statement, and it's very complicated. So it's still an ongoing investigation.
Why should NATO be blowing up bombs in Western Europe and blaming it on somebody else? I mean, most of us think of NATO as a military protection for members of the public in the West.
That's the way I thought of NATO as well in the beginning. I mean, at school, you know, in school I was told that NATO helps to protect democracies, and that you're on the other side of the Iron Curtain with the Warsaw Pact, and there we know they had no respect for human rights and civil rights and crushed down people and everything else, and we know all the details about that. But we know very little, in fact, about secret policies that were carried out in Western Europe during the Cold War. And when I researched for my book, it took me about 4 years, you know, I wrote to NATO and asked them about documentation. I wrote to the CIA and etc. It was part of my PhD at the London School of Economics. I was there and I was in other countries, and it just turned out that NATO wouldn't want to talk about it. So all I learned was really from Italian generals who were directing these secret armies, and they explained that NATO, CIA and MI6 were concerned about the threat of a Soviet invasion. That was one purpose. And they were concerned about opposition within the countries that belong to NATO. And they used a strategy of tension, which basically means that you carry out a false flag terrorist attack and blame it on somebody else. Blame it on your political opponent. Today that would be a Muslim jihadist Al-Qaeda thing. But back in the Cold War, the false flag obviously was blamed on communists. So people at the time had no chance to find out who was really behind the attack. And now, even with 30 or 40 years distance for us as historians, it's very, very difficult to reconstruct the whole story.
Well, I then asked Daniela Ganser, the author of NATO's Secret Armies and Terrorism in Western Europe, about this whole thorny problem of impunity, because many of the people that have been organising these terrorist attacks from NATO headquarters in Brussels over the decades are still working there.
The case of the Brabant massacres. The case was that in the 80s, you know, people went shopping in Belgium in the supermarkets, and then you had a group of people armed, specially trained men, not, you know, not small robbers who hit you and then run away, but specially armed and specially trained men who came with their cars, stopped in front of the supermarkets and shot down the people who were there shopping. They didn't even take much money. And you know, some people were running and crying, say, that's my child, and they just killed them, cold-blooded. And in some other instances, the police, who was alarmed and raced to the crime scene, they didn't run away from the police. They even waited for the police to come and shot them too. So they acted like special forces soldiers in a war. I mean, that's what soldiers do. They kill each other. But if you put this situation into a civilian world, like take Belgium, take people's supermarkets, take police office, then you suddenly find out there's something very wrong going on here. And when the Belgian Senate heard in 1990 that in Italy that you had the secret army linked to NATO, which was discovered, you had the Belgian defense minister, Guy Coëm, who flew back from Rome. He happened to be in Italy. So he flew back to Belgium and asked his chief of staff, do we have a secret army in Belgium too? I know nothing about it. And then his chief of staff, which is the highest ranking military in Belgium, said, yes, yes, we have such a secret army. And he said, why don't I know anything about it? And then he said, well, we need an investigation into this whole matter, and we need to find out whether our secret army was linked to these attacks on our population, you know, and whether NATO had anything to do with it. So the Belgian Senate set up a special group of parliamentarians who had to investigate this story. And the incredible thing is that the Secret Service in Belgium just refused to hand out the names. They just didn't give the names of the people who were involved in the secret army. And so researching state terrorism goes to a certain point where suddenly you stop and you don't get the final names and you don't get the courts to actually take over action, because killing people in democracy is just illegal, you know. It's, in the end, it's a question for the courts to handle. But there is nobody condemned for it. Nobody. We just didn't get the names.
There Now, I know that the Belgian supermarket attacks happened at a very tense point between Europe and America, where the United States was very keen to have cruise missiles based in Europe, a little bit maybe like the modern-day missile defence shield in Eastern Europe is coming in. The Belgian government didn't want it. Now, after these supermarket attacks, the Belgian government immediately said, well, yes, it does look like there is a threat from the Soviet Union. We better have the cruise missiles.
You always have a political context that actually would favor destabilization. I mean, it's if somebody looks from it from a distance, and I'm saying from a very immoral point of view, you can say it's very easy to take special forces, to take, you know, secret service operatives who are trained in military warfare and put them into a civilian context. I mean, how easy is that? People shopping, I mean, that's very easy to attack them. And then to cover up the traces is rather easy as well, if you have protection from higher levels. We have right-wing people involved in Belgium, for instance. The Westland New Post was a group of right-wing extremists, and they were involved. And they all said, you know, we checked out when the supermarkets were open, when they closed, and all these details, and whether they had protection or not. And then the journalists, the Belgian journalists who worked on this data, asked the people from the Westland New Post, did you actually carry out the attacks? And then they said, no, no, we didn't do it, but we have protection. We were always in contact with people from NATO and CIA and MI6. So it's always the same group popping up. And then in the end, if you ask CIA, I mean, I placed a Freedom of Information request with the CIA on Gladio and Stay Behind, the NATO secret armies. And they just said, you know, we put you on a waiting list and give you an answer in due course. And that's like 8 years ago.
That was Danny Eleganza. I was speaking to him a couple of weeks ago, and he is the author of the book NATO's Secret Armies, and he's based in Switzerland, even though he did his initial research for his PhD here at the London School of Economics. Now, Martin Summers, the implication here, because we're looking at this in conjunction with the anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, is that actually there is a track record of these kind of false flag attacks. Can you give us your take on this whole false flag business?
Well, I mean, I must say I've read Daniel's books, and I'm very familiar with the material he's talking about. There is obviously a question mark over Islamist terrorism when we have a context in which NATO has been involved in false flag terrorism in the past. And that's not conspiracy theory, as you so rightly pointed out at the beginning of this piece. This is all historically documented fact. Bologna railway station was blown up in 1980. I slept in the railway station a week before it was blown up. 86 people died. It was not carried out by the Red Brigades or the neo-fascists. It was carried out by the intelligence services and including MI6. Now, so MI6 have got a track record of blowing up innocent people in order to try and create political effects, and nobody has been punished. And are we surprised that some 50-odd people die on the London Underground on July the 7th? Now, it may be that the story is as the government says, and four random bombers with no mastermind got themselves together and blew themselves up just because they hated our freedoms or whatever the story is. But it's perfectly legitimate for us to ask, as I did ask it when I spoke at Birmingham Central Mosque a few years ago, is this a false flag attack? That's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. But it may or may not be, but it's an absolutely legitimate question.
Is there actually any evidence that it was a false flag attack, the 7/7 London bombings? Because one thing for certain is we still haven't had a proper public inquiry. The one that's just been announced today into phone hacking, we haven't had the same kind of level of judicial inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings.
Well, as you well know, Tony, it was investigators known to us that uncovered that the train the bombers supposedly caught, which is part of the narrative, they caught the 7 whatever it was from Luton to London.
This is the anonymous government narrative.
Yes, the anonymous government narrative. And through our checking, independent citizen journalist checking, we found that that train didn't run. So they claimed they had CCTV footage of the guys all the way, but they got the train time wrong. Now, how come? What sort of police investigation is it where you've not checked the most basic facts about which train they were or were not on? It suggests immediately that they already have a narrative, that we know who's done this, this is Al-Qaeda, this is the narrative, so we don't need to investigate, we know already. Now, this, of course, is very suspicious. When a bomb goes off, you can't presume you know who did it. It probably takes months to establish what might be the motives and who might have done it. But in most false flag attacks, there's an immediate explanation, and we're told, oh, yes, this is what's happening. It's the communists, it's the Islamists, it's whoever. And when you get an immediate kind of response like that, it should raise suspicions immediately, because in actual fact an investigation will take time to determine who's carried out an attack. If within 24 hours they're saying we know what happened, then immediately you smell a rat.
This idea of the false flag, excuse me, the false flag, isn't it something like to do with naval history?
Yes, to do with 18th century naval warfare. Captain Cockayne, who was the hero of Master and Commander, if people have seen that film, he was famous for his false flag attacks. So he would sail his ship right up to a Spanish or a French ship, flying a Spanish or a French flag, so they would think, oh, here's one of our ships. And then when he got right up close, he'd run up the Jolly Roger or the Butcher's Apron, the British flag, and then he'd open fire. And that was false flag attacks, as in naval warfare in the 18th century. But of course, the concept has since evolved into what we're now talking about.
What might be the motives for the London bombings if it was a false flag attack? Is there an alternative motive?
Well, basically, the Islamists had not done anything to the British people at all up to that point. I mean, 9/11 was supposedly carried out by the Islamists, although in fact it probably wasn't. But the British people basically were getting to the idea, well, you know, we've got nothing against the Muslims. I mean, why should we fight them? So we have to be given a reason to hate them. And that's what that would probably be about if it was a false flag attack.
Well, the day after the 6th anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, we hear from a senior police intelligence analyst who believes the four alleged bombers didn't do it, and he was promptly sacked. So why does he think that? Who did do it, and how's his claim for unfair dismissal going? His name is Tony Farrell, and he worked for the South Yorkshire Police as a senior intelligence analyst. After much soul-searching, he decided the anonymously authored government version of events simply did not make sense, and told his bosses that the terror threat to Britain comes from something he calls the enemy within. I spoke to him earlier this week.
My name's Tony Farrell, and I used to work as a principal intelligence analyst for South Yorkshire Police. I'd been a long servant of the organisation. I joined the service in 1993 and had been a principal intelligence analyst since 1998. I'd also done a little bit of secondment work with the Home Office at the Government Office of Yorkshire and the Humber, working on the Crime Directorate. So I was head of profession for one of the largest police forces in the UK. And in September 2010, I was dismissed from that service as a principal intelligence analyst because of my beliefs. That's where I found myself out of a job. I was dismissed for a belief by the organisation.
Now, what was the belief that you
the
held?
The belief was that it concerned a threat, and that was part of my assignment, to produce a threat assessment. The norm was to assume a threat assessment would cover a multitude of sins of criminality, ranging from antisocial behaviour to, say, terrorism. And it was on the issue of terrorism that the clash occurred. My beliefs on terrorism were such that I no longer believe that the major threat came from Islamic terrorism, but it came really from within. And one of the reasons why that was the case was I became disbelieving of the government narratives on 9/11, and more importantly, perhaps in our country, our government narrative on 7/7. So I could not lie and go along with just the government narrative, believing that our government were telling lies themselves.
Now, that's a bit of a strong accusation to make, particularly because the three of the four alleged London bombers come from Yorkshire, don't they, where you were working?
Well, so I was working for South Yorkshire Police. Now, South Yorkshire Police covers Sheffield, Barnsley, Rotherham and Doncaster, whereas the police jurisdiction covering the alleged bombers was West Yorkshire Police, and in particular Leeds and, I think, Beeston.
So what was it that made you feel that, potentially anyway, that the three guys from Yorkshire that came down to London on the 7th of July 2005 and allegedly blew up tube trains, that the actual threat that day may have been from another source?
This became an emerging issue with me. It was shortly before this threat assessment that it dawned on me, and it dawned on me from open source information. So none of what I'm saying actually comes from police information systems. I had no reason to doubt the authenticity of the government's position on this, and the only reason why it came across on my radar was my home interests and my home research from open source information that any researcher out there in the wider world could actually have access to. So I want to say that first and foremost. But the reasons why I became deeply suspicious was when I watched a YouTube video, and it caused me great concern when it became clear that Peter Power was running the mock terror exercise on the very same day, whereby he is on record as saying the terror exercise was simulating the drill at the exact same locations and times as what actually occurred. And to my mind, that immediately aroused great suspicion. It's been downplayed. It is hugely significant, that, and the fact that that's never been investigated properly and brushed aside as just mere coincidence is deeply, deeply suspicious. And the odds of it being just coincidence alone without any connection is simply so remote as to make it a virtual impossibility. So that was the very first thing. But also, there was some interesting documentaries that were available on open source information on the YouTube, some compelling analysis that had been done, and we're talking things like 7-7 ripple effect, the big picture. These documentations were far more persuasive than the official version and the government versions that were available. So there was the unacceptably inept Home Office anonymous account that had holes in it and actually was proved to have already, you know, by their own admission, has contained lies. And we're talking in terms of the story regarding the train connection from Luton to the Thames link, train into London, St Pancras. Well, that clearly, by admission later, was a lie, and it took researchers to actually reveal to them that that was the case. Other issues, Tony Blair, it was deeply suspicious that Tony Blair did not want an inquiry, and that occurred very quickly, within days, and Tony Blair, even on the day of the attacks, was on record as saying that this was being done in the name of Islam. And that was seen to me premature and run contrary to what the police were saying. So that, again, was deeply suspicious. The profile, the general profile that, of the alleged bombers seems far more consistent with them being set up as patsies rather than bombers. And then there's the reported incidents at Canary Wharf that seem to have been covered up and conveniently unburied, yet they were announced and went across parts of the world, I think, in New Zealand. And quite frankly, the alternative hypothesis that's been put forward seems to me far more likely, that actually at least one or two of those alleged bombers were taken out in Canary Wharf. And the fact that that seems to have just been brushed aside is deeply suspicious.
Do you think then that that there are systemic problems with the way the police analyse terrorism, that they're kind of in a bubble, and that some of this material from outside simply is not being considered by the police?
I have not been a special branch analyst, so I'm not privy to the detailed intelligence that, say, special branch analysts would have access to. What I can say is that, certainly with my treatment, I was tasked as an analyst to do a strategic threat assessment. So it was my analysis that they were wanting. When my analysis challenged the norm, and my analysis went outside the box in as much as didn't rely on simply compute information within the police, the databases, when I used open source information and challenged the police position by genuinely presenting my analysis and saying I could not present analysis that I think would be misleading, to actually be sacked for standing for what I believed as the analyst to be the truth, as opposed to be a misleading or a lie, there clearly is something wrong with the system that feels it necessary to sack an analyst for standing up for the truth and for actually offering. I offered to the police to produce a detailed report to justify exactly why I felt so confident in saying that I felt the government were lying on this, and that there was a threat quite different from the strategic threat that they were articulating and wanted me to perpetuate, all my faith and my conscience simply wouldn't allow that to happen. So I think there is a problem. There is a problem with almost mind control here. You've got to go along with the narrative and you dare not challenge it. And if you challenge it, then your fate could be, in my instance, it's being dismissal. And that's just simply being for a belief and for standing up the truth. And the disappointing aspect is that that seems to run contrary to all the professional standards that the police have, and that means the police don't seem to be walking their talk, I'm afraid.
If the threat, as you say, is not so much from Islamic terrorism, where is the threat from?
I believe squarely that we've got a major issue here, and the threat is an internal one. The threat, I believe, comes from a new world order that actually has an ideology that is evil and wicked. It that ultimately wants to bring about a fascist one world government and police state control. It's an ideology that I believe is a satanic ideology, where the common denominator on all of this is secret societies. and many complex interlinking secret societies that are holding this together. And I'm afraid I think the examples of 9/11 and 7/7 are false flag operations and are examples of the New World Order in operation. And we have that, a New World Order in its ascendancy just at the moment. And that, to my mind, is a far bigger threat than Islamic terrorism.
That was Tony Farrell, former senior intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police, now fighting a case for unfair dismissal. Now, Martin Summers, can you just give us your take on what Tony had to say there?
Well, I think all of the stuff about 7/7 was very much to the point, because he's actually, you know, this guy's paid to analyse these events. He's analysed it correctly, in my view. I think he's jumping to conclusions about who was responsible, and if he says it's New World Order or satanic people or whatever, he means, oh, well, he's just a conspiracy theorist, he just believes silliness. But of course, we've just had Daniel Ganser, who's an academic, pointing out that NATO goes around blowing things up. So it's hardly surprising if we presume that it might be the case in this case as well. Is it? They've got form.
Okay, now, 2 weeks ago, the press was buzzing with the leaked words of David Cameron's boss, Witney constituency chairman Christopher Shale. He said the Tory party needed to so thoroughly re-examine itself. The Conservative Party of 2011, he said, was voracious, crass and always on the take. 3 days later, his dead body was found in a public portaloo at the Glastonbury Festival. A swift post-mortem was carried out, but the pathologist said the cause of death appeared to be a natural heart attack, but it was inconclusive. Around the world, there are a few people who specialised in these possible political assassinations, and one is barrister and member of the Royal United Services Institute, Michael Shrimpton. I spoke to him earlier this week from what he called a safe house in New Zealand.
I'm Michael Shrimpton. I am a barrister, that's my day job, but I specialise in intelligence and national security, and in particular I specialise in the esoteric field of counter-assassination or investigation of possible assassinations. But listeners will understand I am expressing myself with lawyerly caution, and in the intelligence community we always express any conclusion with qualifications, but at this stage, given the intelligence that's available, I conclude on the balance of probabilities that Christopher Shale was assassinated, and the probable assassinating agency is GO2, or General Operations 2, which is the UK operation of the covert German Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst, or DVD, intelligence agency. So it looks as though he was assassinated. That is my conclusion on balance at this moment. And it looks as though the assassinating agency is German, not British.
Now, can you tell us why you think that?
Well, he was certainly in possession of what we call bio-leverage, or high-grade intelligence damaging to a senior member of the government, and was in a position to bring it down. And for geopolitical reasons, at the moment, Germany would not wish to see the coalition government collapse. So he was in possession of sensitive information.
What was that sensitive information?
That's... I'm aware of it. You wouldn't be able to broadcast it if I were to tell you. And if listeners could bear with me, I'm sure they will appreciate that it's simply not intelligence that I could put out over a public radio broadcast. It is sensitive. The senior RAF officer, Air Chief Marshal Sir Christopher Moran, was assassinated again by GO2, again on behalf of the DVD, on 26th May of last year at RAF Bryce Norton, which is in Mr. Shale's West Oxfordshire constituency area. And he was a former officer, of course, 17th 21st Lancers. He did have contacts with the Defence Intelligence Staff, and it's possible, I put it no higher than that, it is possible that he had intelligence on the assassination of Sir Christopher Moran, which is again put down to death by natural causes officially.
Do you think that that there is really any evidence that that really takes place here in Britain?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, we've only got to look at the assassination of David Kelly, for example, which is clearly murder, to see that we have political assassinations. David Kelly's is the latest in a series, but these are not assassinations carried out by British agencies. They are assassinations carried out by overseas agencies, although they may false flag it through British citizens or their assets in British agencies. So one has to be very, very careful. This is nothing to do, for example, with MI5, who are the good guys, nor anything to do with MI6, although there is a penetration problem of GO2 inside both 5 and 6. So it's important to emphasise that British security agencies don't get themselves involved in political assassinations, and neither the Kelly assassination nor this one, nor Sir Christopher Moran, was originated in London. The originating agency was based in Munich.
Now, it sounds to me, Michael, that MI5 was supposed to stop this kind of thing going on and have a massive budget of hundreds of millions of pounds to do it, aren't doing their job.
The facts are not entirely clear. The probable assassination was only on Saturday the 25th. There's more work still to be done. But at this stage, I don't think there's any ground for criticising the security service. Now, it looks as though the two GO2 teams, came out of London on Friday the 24th, but they were travelling by separate routes. The teams both met up in London. MI5 may or may not have been tracking one or more members of both teams, but they weren't aware of the target. On the information available to me, they didn't know what was happening, they didn't know who the target was, and there may be some slight ground for criticising lack of coordination on a weekend. I suspect probably the duty officer ought to have called the director in. That would have been a difficult call to make at the time. So although MI5 may have picked up on one or more members of the two teams that were involved, one was a backup, there's always a backup team, it would be unfair to criticise the security service. When an assassination happens, any intelligence agency is going to review it, and most reviewers will come up with suggestions as to what could have been done better in the light of hindsight, but I think it would be unfair to criticise MI5 at this stage.
Now, many people will be thinking, Michael, that what you're saying is just a little bit of wild speculation. Why should we believe what you have to say?
Well, they don't have to believe it. I mean, people have to, people form their own judgment. This is one of my areas of professional expertise. I'm one of the few that is involved in this area, and certainly one of the few that acts, as it were, as a convert between the intelligence community and the wider public. That's partly because I'm not an intelligence officer. I'm not employed by any intelligence agency. I have a degree of independence. I'd like to think I've got a track record of getting assassinations right. I have a track record of rejecting assassinations when they've been put forward as a possible reason for a death or an accident. People have to form their own judgments.
Why do you think, then, that this hasn't really appeared anywhere in the British press at all? Everybody is saying that he's had a heart attack and it's all just an accident.
You see, a lot of assassinations are disguised as heart attacks. Heart attacks are very, very popular. You always have to look at the cause of the heart attack. So the minute you say to an intelligence professional, oh, the death was by a heart attack, that immediately raises concerns. Disguising a heart attack is an extremely popular method of carrying out an assassination that you don't want to present it as an assassination. If you're trying to disguise what you're doing, you're going to want it as an accident or a suicide or death by natural causes. Heart attacks are very popular, particularly if the subject is, like Mr. Shale was, male in his 50s or his 60s. So saying it was a heart attack to an intelligence professional doesn't take the issue much further.
Now, that was, we were speaking there to Michael Shrimpton, who was from the Royal United Services Institute, and around the world there are a few people who specialise in possible political assassinations as he does, and he's talking to us from a safe house in New Zealand. Just to remind you again about the cycle ride, the blog is Kev's Climate Column, and his number's 07768 991 063, and he'll be based in Poulton near Cirencester during the Fairford Air Tattoo. Thanks very much for joining us. thisweek.org.uk is our website. See you next week.
Station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Britain